Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Governor Pritzker sure likes pressing the panic button, doesn't he? And when he presses it, he keeps his finger pressed down, as we know from the nation's longest COVID disaster declaration executive order streak. Yesterday, Spalding issued another emergency disaster proclamation, and this in response to the migrants that have been bussed up to Chicago Metro from Texas. So we've got a couple of busloads of migrants that have been shipped up here, and now it's all hands on deck. It's a statewide emergency. Remember, this is a sanctuary state. Was that just window dressing, virtue signaling, as the kids say? Was that not a serious policy decision, designating Illinois as a sanctuary state? Was that something just to, you know, put on a banner around the Capitol? Or was that a well-thought-out policy with an understanding of the implications? Huh. So now Pritzker has activated 75 members of the Illinois National Guard to, quote, ensure all state resources are available to support asylum seekers arriving nearly daily to Chicago from the state of Texas, he said. We got a border crisis in Illinois, but they don't have one at the border states, because if they did, I'm sure that our leading lights of the left would have been commenting on it, lo, this many years, right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Not only do we need to scramble six dozen National Guardsmen in Illinois to provide a city with a $15 billion budget, the necessary manpower and resources to, I guess, bus the migrants who arrive in Chicago out to Elk Grove Village and Burr Ridge, where they are put up in hotels. Not only do we need to do that, according to Triple Threat, who doubled down, we need federal support. FEMA. And let's get beyond FEMA to really rattling the tin can around the rail in D.C., and getting all the cash that Chicago and Illinois deserve to take care of this border crisis we've got in Chicago.
But if this moment continues for weeks and months, there has to be more. There's a finite number of resources that are available through FEMA. We intend to get every single penny that we possibly can. But I meant what I said earlier, if monies are going to Texas and they're abdicating the responsibilities that they agreed to, to get those monies need to be reprogrammed and sent to states and cities like Chicago, like New York, Washington, D.C. New York, to date, as of yesterday, had 11,000 people that had come to New York City. I mean, contemplate that number. And we need, D.C. needs more assistance. And obviously, I know that there's work being done by the White House and some of the executive agencies to look to other resources. That can't happen fast enough.
So we should divert any federal support to Texas, to Chicago, to handle our immigration crisis here. And can you imagine 11,000 migrants being sent to New York in a city of just 8.4 million people? and the untold resources that New York has, which of course dwarfs Chicago's pretty substantial at $15 billion. I go back to that number. I just love the all hands on deck national crisis because of a couple of busloads of migrants from Texas to Chicago. Disaster declarations from the governor, calls for FEMA assistance from the mayor, redirect resources from border states that see an influx of thousands of migrants daily to Chicago.
They're not only doing that. There's also a criminal investigation into Greg Abbott because Governor Pritzker claims these people are being human trafficked, sent here against their will. You can't make this stuff up.
Waivers, they knew exactly where they were going. Some wanted to go to Chicago because they have family members in the surrounding states. So you're saying
they signed a piece of paper is what I'm asking.
I'm suggesting to you that even if someone signed a piece of paper, if it was in English and they don't speak English, if it was in Spanish and they don't read or write, that's not an appropriate way to, you know, for the governor of Texas to release himself from liability.
Oh, I'm glad you're finally putting that Georgetown law degree to work there, Governor. You're saying they didn't have the mens rea to enter into a contract. It's not a contract. I wonder if Greg Abbott and his team, I wonder if they've got any Spanish speakers available to them down in Texas. I mean, are you serious? This guy is such a fraud. You know, it's because he's never had to manage a gosh darn thing in his life. He started on third base. He thinks he hit a triple. He thinks he's an entrepreneur. That's a joke. I mean, third base. He started about 6 inches from home because he's born into this billionaire family. He's never had a freaking job. He's never done anything. He's never had to manage anything, which is why everything that confronts him is a crisis, and it's somebody else's responsibility to bail him out. What they're both talking about is bailing out Chicago by Illinois taxpayers, bailing out Illinois taxpayers by federal taxpayers, by the rest of the country.
Right.
Illinois bails out Chicago, and the United States bails out Illinois.
And he went on to say, I mean, he was race baiting the whole time, saying that, you know, these people are here legally. And I don't know who he's talking about. And I wanted to ask him, but of course, they cut off the questions right away because he can't handle a flippin' question.
These are people who have not been accused of doing anything wrong. But upon arrival here, there have been some anti-immigrant people who have tried to label these refugees with vicious suspicions about drugs and guns, accusations of which there is literally not a shred of evidence. The arriving families are poor, and they are people of color. And that's apparently all some people need to level baseless accusations.
I mean, the ones that we featured here on this show, she was a mother of two who's a civil engineer. No, who is saying these are criminals that we're letting into our country? No one. Not on this station. Not anywhere that I've seen or read. He's race baiting at
of course. That's
God,
what he does.
It's sickening.
It's always the race hustle.
And they're saying they're being held against their will and taken on the buses. They call him Señor Transporte, Mr. Transportation. They love Greg Abbott. Everyone that got off that bus that was interviewed by every station, if his team would even watch the frickin' local news, would know that they're very respectful. We're going to try to acclimate into this society. Please give us a chance, is what I heard another guy say. And it's not like it's inhumane. The treatment, they are lucky to get on the buses that are, they're charter
it's
buses.
It's just a scam.
It's air-conditioned
it's
movies.
A scam.
A bathroom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we're putting them on a yellow school bus without air conditioning and send them to God knows where. They know where they're going. You're right. It's a scam. The whole thing's a scam.
Let me be clear, Pritzker said. While other states may be treating these vulnerable families as pawns, here in Illinois, we're treating them as people.
Hey.
I don't know. Do you ever tire of this rap from, I mean, really? The worst possible messenger for this hustle. I mean, the most incredible messenger for this race hustle. This silver spooned buffoon.
He's a buffoon.
That has had no contact with anybody outside of the rarefied circles of the billionaire class, until he decided that wearing the sash of some public office was going to be the mark he makes in this world.
It's the only thing he can do.
You had Blago on for me last week. But it would have been nice to go back and listen to the tapes between him and Blago and how J.B. Pritzker talked about these people of color that he wraps himself, that he uses to wrap around himself.
And that Jesse White's one of the good black guys.
Yeah, right. How he talked about them back in the day when he was searching for an office to be gifted to him by Blagojevich. Because that's what Jelly Belly does. He preens and he solicits gifts. Because that's all he's known. Cocktail parties and bailouts. Somebody else takes care of my business. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Good morning, all. I just wanted to add that, you know, these folks on the Democratic side will say anything and see what sticks on the wall because no one fact checks them properly. 90% of the media does not fact check them. So why not just say whatever and see what flies with the American public? I mean, I thought I saw this morning that Governor DeSantis is sending illegals to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah,
and,
to busloads.
And they say, all these people want, they're breaking the law, number one. They're breaking the law first. They're criminals, all of them.
Well,
they're coming over here illegally.
Well, there's the issue, thanks for the call, Marvin, there's the issue of Biden administration policy, and this gets lost in the discussion because we have to listen to the sort of sophistry that you've heard from Spalding and Triple Threat over the last week and a half. It's the Remain in Mexico policy with respect to asylum seekers. And this is something that the Trump administration advanced, Remain in Mexico. This is something that the Biden administration rescinded as of August. This is something that went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says the Biden administration has the authority to rescind the Remain in Mexico policy and let asylum seekers into this country. Then they delayed discarding the Remain in Mexico policy into July. I mean, so this has been a back and forth. But part of this is, again, a conversation about federal immigration policy and what to do with people who are at least legitimately pursuing asylum, whether their claim is legitimate or not. They're going through the process and whether they should be allowed to freely move about the country pending their asylum application, or whether they should have to remain in Mexico pending the adjudication of their asylum application. That's a big discussion that's getting lost in this, and that's the policy discussion we should be having.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I cannot resist a clash between Rand Paul and Tony Fauci. I don't care how far removed we are from the COVID pandemic, although for some people it's not very far.
Although they're still all in, Dan. Still wearing masks.
And we're still in this argument about the COVID jab protocol, as we're supposed to now, I guess, move to this idea that it's an annual exercise like the flu shot. And nothing more, right?
Yeah, that's what they say. That's how they're marketing it now.
But the they is just the COVIDians in this country, because the they in other countries are saying something different. But we'll get to that in a second. A fun exchange yesterday between Rand Paul and Tony Fauci. Rand Paul is licking his chops for Senate Republican control. The country should give Republicans control of the Senate, if for no other reason, so that Tony Fauci is whistled back before Rand Paul, even in retirement. So there's two issues here. One is that are addressed, and you'll hear sort of the tail end of the first issue. The first issue is the CDC's guidelines on the vaccine for those who've been infected, which has been a running fight for the better part of the last 2 years, well, since the vaccines came online. And then the other matter of royalties and the disclosure of royalties from big pharma companies or other institutions to CDC employees like one Tony Fauci. Take a listen.
Guidelines for vaccines. You know, do any of the guidelines for vaccines from the government include previous infection as something to base your decision making on with vaccines? Do any of the guidelines involve previous infection? That's why you're ignoring previous infection, because it doesn't involve any of the guidelines. And furthermore, we've been asking you, and you refuse to answer, whether anybody on the vaccine committees gets royalties from the pharmaceutical companies. I asked you last time, and what was your response? We don't have to tell you.
Right.
We've demanded them through Freedom of Information Act, and what have you said? We're not going to tell you. But I tell you this, when we get in charge, we're going to change the rules, and you will have to divulge where you get your royalties from what companies, and if anybody on the committee has a conflict of interest, we're going to learn about it. I promise you that.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that, please?
Hey.
Okay, there are two aspects for what you said. You keep saying you approve, you do this, you do that. The committees that give the approval are FDA through their advisory committee. The committees that recommend are CDC through their advisory committee. And you keep saying, I'm the one that's approving a vaccine based on certain data. So I don't really understand, with all due respect, Senator.
You're the one that said you would not reveal, no, you would not reveal what companies gave you royalties, or what company gave the other scientists royalties.
Got to move on.
You told the committee.
Senator Paul,
sir,
you got to move on.
Could I please answer that?
Briefly,
you keep asking committees. They're not my committees. They're the VRBPAC committee for the FDA and the ACIP for the CDC. So I don't have any idea what goes on.
And they won't reveal, as well as you won't reveal.
Okay,
what
we're gonna move on.
Mm-hmm. No, please don't move on.
Yeah, so it's such a wonderful illustration of how, you know, bureaucracy is able to avoid accountability. Tony Fauci has been the face of the CDC. I don't care what his technical position is. I don't care what committees he does or does not sit on within the agencies, whether it's CDC or NIAID, give me a break. All roads lead through Tony Fauci, and they have for almost the entirety of this pandemic, that's for sure. Been the point person, certainly for the last 2 years under Biden, and was for most of the time under Trump, the last year of the Trump administration. So this idea that there's these committees and they do this work and I hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. No, I don't think so. You can't get away with it. You can't get away with being the point person, being at the top of the pyramid, at least with respect to comms. And it seems like with respect to decision making, and certainly with respect to influence where the decision making should occur, the White House, Congress, and then say, you know, these issues you bring up, they're not my decisions, they're group decisions. We have these committees, we have this flow chart of decision making, And that's the process by which it's not Tony Fauci CDC. Tony Fauci knows or should know what's going on. Tony Fauci likes to take positions on all sorts of things. Is this a guy who stayed in his lane over the last 3 years?
No.
I don't think so.
He commented about January 6th, calling it an insurrection. That's none of his business.
So, but he has no comment about the disclosure of royalties by him and all CDC employees, taxpayer funded, as it pertains to pharma companies, and as it pertains essentially the underlying issue, conflicts of interest.
He didn't answer the question because he's getting royalties from pharmaceutical companies.
I mean, he has, yes, he has this financial disclosure statement that he files. And so, but we're talking about a deeper dig. And these are people who like to throw around the word transparency in order to not have to practice it. Brand themselves as proponents of transparency so they can operate in opacity.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And it's tough. It's tough for Rand Paul to get everything in 6 or 7 minutes that you have, you know, your turn at the wheel for these hearings. But I wish there would be more explication of these sorts of exchanges so people understand the questions that are being asked, why they're being asked, and the ruse that is used to avoid being frank with the public. And it's a great example of how bureaucracy avoids accountability. And you're talking, I mean, you couldn't have a higher profile example. As it pertains to the vaccines, I don't know where people are at with their jabs.
We're number five now.
Well, in terms of what you're actually doing about it or what you're planning on doing about it with this annual protocol that we're transitioning to. But I do know this, Denmark will prohibit almost everyone under the age of 50 from receiving any more mRNA COVID jabs. The Danish Health Authority said Danes under 50 will only be allowed to receive the shots if they are at higher risk of becoming severely sick from COVID-19. They did not explicitly say the risks of the mRNA jabs outweigh the benefits for healthy people under the age of 50, but it's implicit in the announcement, isn't it? They're doing this, by the way, banning shots for people under 50, except in extraordinary circumstances, even though they expect a, quote, large wave of COVID infection in the next few months. In other words, winter. Huh.
Why? What do they know that we don't know?
Why would they do that? Are they just, is it just a bunch of MAGA extremists over in Denmark? Has Denmark been taken over by MAGA extremists? That seems to be the only explanation. The Danish Health Authority writing in their statement, the purpose of vaccination is not to prevent infection with COVID-19. Right. It used to be, though, or at least that's what we were told. And people under the age of 50 are therefore currently not being offered booster vaccination. They're generally not particularly at particularly high risk of becoming severely ill from COVID-19. And they're well protected becoming severely ill from COVID-19. Generally not particularly high risk of becoming severely ill, generally well protected, sort of two statements saying the same thing in different ways. And there's constantly good immunity among this part of the population. You know, and I know that folks in the Bernie bro camp and often point to our Scandinavian friends as the model for the United States. So here again, is this part of the modeling you'd like to incorporate here? Uh-huh. Our friend Alex Berenson writes at his Substack, the Danish move is particularly significant because Denmark has an excellent national healthcare system and has aggressively collected data on COVID and vaccines. It was one of the first countries to stop giving COVID shots to healthy children and teenagers. Now other European countries are beginning to follow, with Britain ending mRNA shots for almost all children 10 and under. And where are we with that?
Oh, we're setting up shops now. Get your kids boosted. They're doing it in schools. You can sign up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or go to a local college. They have, you know, booster shots available this weekend.
Under the age of 50. This is Denmark and other European countries. You know, some of the same countries that kept the kids in school for most of the time. Certainly, they were back in the classroom if they ever left. In Sweden, they didn't. Back in the classroom months and months and months earlier than we even started to get most kids back in the classroom in this country. Who is right? Is it important? I think so. You need to continue to disseminate information about the consequences of the choices that were made. What we thought we knew, I mean, we were doing this the entire time, but it cannot stop. What we thought we knew, what we were told they knew, and now what we're finding out is true.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, hey, you know, that addition of 87,000 agents to the IRS may not be such a bad idea after all. You know why?
Why?
Because we need somebody to audit the auditors. Thanks to Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa, there is now a Department of Treasury audit of the IRS because it's come to light that in 2019, pre-pandemic, 1,250 employees of the IRS didn't pay their taxes.
1,200?
More than 300 of them were repeat offenders.
Come on, you can't make this stuff up.
And then they get those that were queried, according to the reporting on here, had excuses like, I forgot, I had technical issues, I don't know how to do it.
They work for the IRS. Their buddy could walk them through it if they needed it.
Yeah, we need those agents. We need those new IRS agents to audit the IRS agents. Okay, sure. Speaking of auditing, I mean, I just love this story. This is like so classic big government.
Do they get to keep their jobs?
It's beyond parody. Well, sure, you know, just got to get right with their employer, you know.
They have technical issues, right?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I mean, do you care about following the money when it comes to all of the money that was printed and distributed willy-nilly to paper over, if you will, the government's lockdown policies? Do you care? I suppose if you don't care about other people's money, even though it was your money that was distributed to other people, including yourself, because everybody stands in line for their own payment, bribing people with their own money, as it were. Not in the case of PPP. Again, I stipulate proponent of the program after the government locked down the economy because that was a government taking, and so businesses should be compensated for right. the harm that was done by government. There's no question about that. But that doesn't mean that you distribute money willy-nilly, that there are no controls, and that you don't look to claw back money that was frauded out of the system or stolen. Well, fraud is one form of theft, but I mean stolen outright by online
people overseas. Yeah,
cyber attacks and so forth. Exactly.
People applying for PPP loans while they're in prison. And one got them. You had to pay it back, though.
So I mean, and I know there's some prosecutions that have occurred of people who frauded the government, but I don't think you have an idea of the scale of perhaps the wrongdoing that was afoot. And I don't think I had a scale, had an appreciation for the scale of it either until Chicago City Wire took a look at the PPP distribution in Chicago Metro. These numbers.
It's fascinating.
Very curious.
And we only scratched the surface last time we talked about it.
We've got them by, now we've got them, including the collar counties, by county as well as by municipality within county, or in the case of Chicago, by neighborhood within the city. Let me give you an example of what we're talking about. West Garfield Park, that had the, I think last year, had the highest shootings per capita in the city. The per capita shooting rate was 20 times the city average. Oof. West Garfield Park residents secured 6,282 PPP loans, quote-unquote loans, totaling more than $120 million last year. That was also tops per capita in the city. That's one PPP loan for every 3.4 persons in West Garfield Park. By contrast, say, I don't know, in Roselle, there was one PPP loan for every 25 residents.
Okay.
So one for every three in Garfield Park, one for every 24 in Roselle, just to give you sort of a sense of the spread from middle-income suburban community to West Garfield Park. And
that's a lot of people owning a lot of businesses in West Garfield Park.
And I want to make a note here. PPP loans were provided legitimately to sole proprietorships, to independent contractors. They were eligible.
Right.
So
how did everybody in West Garfield Park know about the government give-out?
Well, I mean, it was pretty well publicized. Mm-hmm. The question is,
I know people got turned down when they applied for PPP loans.
All of these are legitimate sole proprietorships or independent contractors or associated with an S corp or C corp, a business that's identifiable that has employees. Yeah. The neighborhood has only 21,000 working-age adults, 4,700 of whom told the census they were unemployed. About another 10,500 West Garfield Park residents claim to be out of the workforce, not even looking for jobs. That leaves about 6,000 who are gainfully employed, if not also employing others. About 6,000. They got 6,282 PPP loans in that neighborhood. Not picking on this neighborhood because I think there's questions that span the city and the region and then by definition the country. I'm sure this is not something that is completely anomalous to Chicago. But, you know, you say, well, the West Garfield Park loans average about $19,000 apiece. So, you know, that's too small. It's small potatoes. That's nothing to worry about. Don't fret about it. It's nothing to pay attention to. We got bigger fish to fry. Prosecutors aren't going to pay attention to that. You know, 19,000. It's sort of like if you steal less than $1,000 of merchandise from a retailer. Whatever. We don't got time for that. We got bigger fish to fry. Okay, well, you know, that adds up. You know, when you got, you're giving Dole out $20,000 at a time across a big population, turns out to be a pretty big number. Just West Garfield Park was $120 million in Chicago. And I'm not saying all of these were frauded or all these are legitimate, but I'm talking about these are big numbers. And so if a significant percentage of it is questionable, it's probably something worth investigating. Chicago, just Chicago, 165,000 Chicagoans received PPP loans under $25,000. Just looking at Chicagoans, less than $25,000. That's $2.78 billion. Oof. Is that real money yet? Tell me when it gets to real money.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Chicago's Austin neighborhood, where 60% of the men aged 20 to 24 are neither employed or in school, received 7,470 Paycheck Protection Program loans, quote, totaling $142 million. That's three times what Kendall County received, twice what McHenry County received, about the same as Kane County. Kane County has a population of 500,000 people. And here's the thing. Is, you know, dare, lest I be called a racist here because I'm comparing city neighborhoods to suburbs. Number one, just prove up the sole proprietorships and the independent contractors. And if they prove up, then fine. This should be looked at, and should be looked at in the suburbs, too. Nobody should be exempt from scrutiny. But it's just dishonest. And I'm not even talking about the quote-unquote fraud. That's not going to be considered fraud. That's not going to be prosecuted. If the point here was just to drop ship cash to lower income people in lower income neighborhoods or communities, well, then why don't you just say it? Rather than going through the machinations and funding bureaucracies to distribute, to come up with, you know, half-baked applications and stipulations that must be met. Why don't you just say, in addition to the $1,500 relief check, we're also going to give you access to apply to loans that could be forgivable of up to $25,000. If your household income is under the poverty line, we're just going to give you $25,000. You know what? Then we could debate it on the merits. But here, and I'm not saying everyone, but I'm saying it is very hard to reconcile these numbers and not, and understanding what we know about fraud with respect to COVID funds generally in the hundreds of billions, at least. You know what's going on here. I mean, come on. We're in Chicago. How Pollyannish are we going to be about this? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text site. In addition to that, as Rick Santelli eloquently said this week on the occasion of the August inflation number, the godfather, Rick Santelli.
The thing that really bothers me with regard to inflation is everybody here on this panel agreed months ago that one of the reasons inflation was high was all the government spending. And after we agreed on that, what did the government do? They spent more. Student loans, welfare in terms of the CHIPS Act. Seems like nothing is sinking in. These numbers aren't better than expected. And maybe they should be. And maybe ultimately they're going to start to go back up again because we continue to go back to that well of debt and spending.
Right. So now the 13% increase in your grocery bill and so on and so forth. I mean, you trace this back to exactly what Santelli is talking about. We seem to agree that government printing and distributing money was inflationary. Now we're living with it. So how about we connect some dots here? Profligate spending, setting up programs with little oversight.
And now a loaf of bread is $4. You know, exactly like we predicted. They were handing out money. They were giving money to rich parents in CPS for you know, to supplement lunches.
Action, consequence, action, reaction. Are we familiar with this concept? I mean, is this – so does it become a little bit more relevant? And so this never-ending blood out of your left arm to put it in your right arm and spill a bunch on the floor, this is just another example of it. Oh, we gave you all this money, and now you can spend it freely, and there's no consequences, even if you got it illicitly and you spent it on things that were not intended to be, it was not intended to be spent on. Well, now you're paying the price literally at the pump, at the grocery store, on your energy bill, and you're going to continue to do so.
Yeah, there's no end in sight.
So what did we accomplish with all of this?
And then the government gave us money even though we kept our jobs. I mean, I received money, and then child tax credit too from Biden.
Right, because everybody has to get their deal. That's how a kleptocracy works. That's how it sustains itself. You have to cut enough people in that the people cut out are a minority.
And this, we're getting this property tax rebate from Pritzker that's going to be rolled out within the next 6 to 8 weeks, which leads to the election.
Yet another
buying
scam.
Votes. Another total scam.
Raise your taxes in the thousands.
Yes.
Permanently. Provide temporary relief in the hundreds, and call that tax relief.
And people are dumb enough to buy it.
But
man,
if you're going to allow yourself to be bribed with your own money, if you're going to allow the race hustle with respect to migrants or crime, the tax and spend hustle that Pritzker is running, if you're going to allow that to win the day, then you're not going to have much of a state or much of a country. Mike on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I just wanted to say that, you know, first of all, I agree with you that we are dealing with real numbers here. And secondly, you know, I wanted to unpack this thing about the PPE loans and the DBAs and everything. So I own property on the west side. And I often talk to one of the kids who lives adjacent to one of my properties. And when this was all happening in 2020, he had mentioned to me, he's like, well, you're my cousin's an accountant, and he can get you a $10,000 loan, this and that, blah, blah. All you can do is set up a DBA. And I'm like, yeah. I go, you don't think that the IRS is going to realize that you're trying to get a PPE loan for your employees when your EIN is only 30 minutes old? So, you know, shame on – I mean, seriously, you know, shame on the IRS for approving all this and just letting this money run rampant. So here's a couple of the effects of this. You know, first of all, I've tracked some of this spending because I was curious about it. And there's a website called COVIDBailoutTracker.com. And this basically has everything from the airlines all the way down to these small DBAs. And you can search by city. You can search by zip code. And at the time, you were able to do it by address. So I looked up some areas on the west side of Chicago and on some very heavily gang infested, very active drug distribution blocks. And I seen that on average, some of these blocks were receiving $250,000+ on, you know, maybe 30 addresses on one block. So we're talking a city block is 500 feet long and you're dumping $250,000. But the average is about $10,000 alone. Known gang members. So now, where does this federal money go? Buy heroin, buy guns, buy cars. So essentially, all the gun violence that happened in Chicago in 2020, 2021 may have been perpetrated by federally funded firearms.
Partially underwritten by your federal tax dollars.
I mean, if you think about it, that is one of the impacts of this. I mean, you know, the feds basically flooded money to purchase guns and for gang wars on the west side of Chicago. And it's something that really should be looked at. That's the main point I wanted to share with you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mike. Interesting point. Yeah. I mean, if Eric Holder can do it at the border, then why not do it nationally?
Hey-o.
Scale it. That's a good point. Unintended consequences, or just sort of willful blindness to the pitfalls of these sorts of gambits. Hey, Tom Oswego.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm a small contractor, and I can tell you it's getting tiring. I only have so much blood in my body to give. I work 60 hours a week, and they come up with some new program that takes another 5,000, so I have to work 65 hours a week. I employ a few guys. They want raises. I gave them raises, but they don't understand that the $3 or $4 raise I just gave them has been eaten up by inflation. They think they're just, you know, they're living high now. And as far as the politicians go, and I've said this before, I really think we're voting in the most stupid people in our population. Or, and maybe I'll correct myself, they're not stupid. They're almost evil stupid because they know what they're doing.
A lot of them are stupid. A lot of them are conniving. Right. Some are both.
This giving out the money, it's basically just bribery. And now they want to audit everybody. Why don't they audit the people that are giving the money out? I bet it's 70-80% corruption. It's got to be high. And now they're giving another $700-800 billion for a new Green Deal. Where is that money going to go?
I don't know.
Oh, you, it's Tom, come, Tom. It's almost like you don't
the think tanks.
It's almost like you don't trust John Podesta to distribute it intelligently. Thanks
give
for the
some
call,
to his
Tom.
Friends.
Yeah,
it's like the creator of Patagonia. You know, he's leaving his billions to help the climate. Well, he's going to just give money to think tanks that aren't going to do anything.
Oh, I thought he was giving his money to the actual climate.
Oh no! I'm sorry. Yeah. To help the climate. Excuse
yeah,
me.
Right. Chuck in Delavan, Wisconsin.
Hey, big shout out to Maureen from St. Charles. I bumped into her in Lake Geneva this weekend. I'm a construction Uh-oh. Superintendent.
Does your girlfriend
know
about this?
I did a
yeah.
building.
Okay.
I did a building over in at 51st and Western, which is right where you're talking about over there. And there's nothing over there. There's some car lots, and then there was a couple of Mexican restaurants. That's about it. And so I don't know, just like what the previous caller said, this could have been gangbangers and stuff that got all this money. And then one more thing I got to tell you really quick. I'm so glad that they shut that strike down because Pat's Brewing Q over in Sharon, every time a train goes by, you get a free shot as they take the soybeans into Kekoman over there to make soy sauce. So,
good
anyway.
To know. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Yeah,
well, one if of everybody the, get your drink on,
yeah,
head on over.
One of the real casualties had there been a rail strike, yeah. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, this whole PPP loan, I want to call it scam, schematic, whatever you want to call it, it really shows how tenuous our economy is and really has been since 1913, since the Federal Reserve was formed. We become an empire of debt, and everybody has all these debts, and if they go unpaid, then you'd get deflation, which the government is deathly afraid of. Yet, we had mild deflation from the 1860s pretty much through World War I. And, you know, we had a lot of economic growth and the middle class grew. But since 1913, we've had the dollar being devalued in effect by 99%. Mm-hmm. And there's all this money has been created, all this debt. And the government had to do that PPP loan, you know, program. Because if it didn't, the whole thing would have fell apart. I mean, think about what a stock is. Let's just take Hormel, for example. It trades at about 46. Its earnings are about $2.50 a share this year. So that means it's got a P.E. ratio of 20, 25, something like that. So basically all of this stuff is based upon future cash flow is what it is. And if that whole thing falls apart, you have a cataclysm economically. You do. So and there's always fraud in every government program, and I'm sure it was a lot with this. But if the government didn't do the PPP loan program and prop up the economy during this self-imposed and stupid lockdown policy, insane. The whole thing would have fallen apart, and they knew it, and that's why they had to do it.
Thanks for the call, Frank.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Freedom Summit Chicago on November 5th. Get your tickets today before they sell out. Go to freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal from Dr. Richard Bosshard. He's a plastic surgeon in Tabarrus, Florida, which reminds me, may have to reach out to him. You know, I'm getting to that age where I probably need a little work done.
Why don't you start with Botox and then you can do threading and then, you know, go for the big nip and tuck?
I think I'm just going to get a butt lift.
You think so?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nobody likes a saggy butt.
No, yeah. Because eventually it starts going down the back of your thighs, yeah.
Hmm. Vivid. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Dr. Bosshard had this to say about critical race theory, which is infecting his profession as a member of the American College of Surgeons. He's been there for 30 years, 84,000-member professional society. He argues the sole focus should be on improving the standard of surgical care. That seems fairly straightforward. But in recent years, it's more focused on promoting critical race theory. He writes, the American College of Surgeons apparently believes its members are racially biased and provide worse care to patients of color than we do to white patients, leading to disparate health outcomes. It's also sending the message that we need anti-racist re-education to overcome our inherent prejudices. Such extraordinary assertions call for the strongest evidence, but the college has yet to provide any. Oh, they don't need evidence. They have moral authority. As a professional society, the college owes its members a frank and honest discussion about the merits of its actions and these ideas. Instead, it is silencing dissent. After I continued to raise concerns about the pervasiveness of critical race theory and the anti-racist philosophy, the college banned me from the online forums and blocked my access to a nationwide directory of my peers. Right, he's only been there 30 years. All of a sudden, he turned into a crank. Yeah, sure. These are the actions of ideologues intent on radicalizing the surgical field instead of improving care. Surgeons can't let that happen. The only way to reverse it is for surgeons to speak out against the corruption of our profession. The American College of Surgeons must choose between surgery and ideology. It seems like that's the same choice in a lot of professions, a lot of critical professions, including the education profession, those who operate on young minds, if you will. What are they going to choose? But it is worth noting, since we spend so much time talking about K-12 and a little bit about corporate America generally, but infecting every profession, including those that are in the business of life and death, like surgeons. That's how serious it is. For more on the education profession, pleased to be joined by Frederick Hess, Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Rick, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, Dan. Good to be with you.
So I know the story from the American College of Surgeons doesn't surprise you, but it does punctuate what's happening, maybe for those who think that it's not real and it's just an isolated debate in K-12 education. Boy, when they're hearing their doctors talk about it in the medical profession, maybe that gets them back to rethinking the propaganda they're hearing from Randy Weingarten when it comes to K-12, that nothing of this sort is happening when it is not only happening, it's pervasive.
Absolutely. And it has, you know, it has real consequences. And, you know, one of the striking things is it's really tends to be promoted in any field by a pretty small number of bullies. But so many people are terrified of being attacked or being treated like the gentleman you were just discussing was treated, that the people who could push back either tend to get intimidated or to keep their heads down, and the bullies just to get away with murder.
You know, the other thing that's interesting is the approach that these identitarian hustlers take. It's worth noting, perhaps the next for the next gambit, maybe we can be a little bit more proactive than some of us have been to this point. Get the DEI administrators in, you know, do the diversity, equity, inclusion person, get that person in, and then he or she brings all their friends. You create a little cottage industry around this one administrative position, and that is all these consultants and trainers that come in with the administrator once you elevate that person to, you know, a powerful spot in your organization, whether it's K-12 or corporate America.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So I wrote about this recently for National Review for the new education issue. And in education, one of the striking things is for all of our conversations over the last year and awareness raising about the problems with anti-racist education, usually talked about as critical race theory, is most teachers, as I'm sure your listeners know, are normal people. Education Week surveys finds that teachers aren't really any more liberal than America. They look a lot like the country does. Only about 5% of teachers self-identify as extremely progressive. Teachers live in our communities. When they do crazy stuff, and there's a handful of teachers who do crazy stuff, but in a profession of almost 4 million, they're, you know, they're the outliers. Teachers have to face kids' parents every day. I've been doing this 30 years. Most teachers I've known really do care about their students, and they're just trying to make sure they feel comfortable. But what happens is school districts spend something like $20 billion a year on teacher training, and they've got to bring in people to do these mandatory trainings for a couple of weeks a year. And what they've gotten into the habit of doing is because it scores them points and because they hand these kinds of trainings over to the DEI coordinators and because this is the hottest thing going in ed schools and foundation circles, is they bring in people to do race-oriented trainings. And they spend a couple of weeks browbeating teachers and then picking up their $10,000 a day and flying off to go do the training elsewhere. And what they do is two things. One, they intimidate teachers into mouthing some of this party line nonsense. And the second thing is they really set a stake in the ground that they don't have to stay around and face parents on, but in which these school communities say that we think individual thought is a legacy of white supremacy culture. We think that teachers ought to promote queer-affirming networks in Buffalo, New York, where teachers are working to disrupt the Western nuclear family. In Seattle, they had trainers, setting the marker that America is a white supremacist society that commits spirit murder against black children. It's no trick at all. Community after community after community, where outsiders have come in, set these markers down, and then collected their checks and flown back to their colleges of education, and then left the communities to clean up afterwards.
Well, tell us about, you wrote about San Diego. What did the trainers there do?
It's hard for me to remember.
Well, about, that whiteness reproduces poverty?
Oh, so sure, you've got this. You've also got trainers in places like Eau Claire, Wisconsin, telling teachers that parents don't have the right to know their child's gender identity.
Right.
That teachers should actively be hiding the child's identity from the parent. Oh, okay. In Davis, California, teachers are told that their job is to decolonize American society and deconstruct normal assumptions of gender. So what's going on here is we're spending $20 billion or more a year on these kinds of trainings. And the really remarkable thing is there is absolutely no evidence that even regular teacher training, even when trainers come in to help teachers teach math better or teach reading better, that this makes any difference in teacher effectiveness. The Federal Institute of Education Sciences, kind of education's NIH, did a massive study of over 600 analyses and evaluations a few years back. And of 643 studies, they could only find two that showed any credible evidence of positive effects. Two out of 643. So given that all of this lunacy is taking place in these workshops, and there's no evidence that these workshops can do what they're supposed to be doing, even when they're run normally, the question arises of whether or not America's schools can actually spend tens of billions of dollars a year more effectively.
Well, so how does this happen? Most teachers, as you described, regular people care about their students, not on board for the politicization of the classroom, don't want to get into racial politics, don't want to work around the parents and keep the parents in the dark. And yet it's happening. So is that just explained by a fear of being ostracized as a racist or not an ally of the LGBTQ, blah, blah, blah? Is that all it is? Or is there, and maybe that's all it is. It's just fear, cowardice.
No,
or is there something else?
You're exactly right. There's more to it. So there's a couple things going on. One, in a lot of school communities, you absolutely do, again, 5 or 6% of teachers self-identify as, very liberals, very progressive. So that's 1 out of 20. So in any school community of any decent size, you've probably got a handful, 3, 4, 5 teachers like this. And I'm sure all of your listeners who work in work environments know that these folks tend to be very upfront about pushing their agenda. And people who say, look, most people I know, even folks on the right, Yeah, we need to be aware of it. We need to think about it. But kind of like the gentleman you started off the segment with, like, we need to see evidence. We need to talk about costs and benefits. So on the one hand, you've got three or four or five radicals, and they're pushing on a bunch of normal people who are trying to judge mixed priorities, and so they get away with murder. Second is school districts, school boards, certainly superintendents, have learned that the way you score points nationally and with education foundations is by talking about America's racism. Mm-hmm. So they certainly don't want to be seen as being on the wrong side of that. Then in their contracts, in teacher contracts, you generally have 2 to 4 weeks of trainings built in where you're bringing in the trainers to do this and set very clear markers around ideology and how to think about identity and race. And so what happens is between their leadership not having their backs, if they push back, and being browbeat by ideological members of their faculty and having expert, quote unquote, trainers coming in from outside and push on them, unless you're really a diehard, very confident conservative, the odds are that you just are going to say, I'm just going to go with the flow on this. And so what happens is we've created cultures where a small number of ideologues wind up driving things in very dramatic ways.
Yeah, maybe that's something that should be challenged that should be put to teachers. Is that what you're teaching the kids? You know, in life, you know, mainly go with the flow, even when you see something wrong. That's the lesson I hope you learn from my instruction, from the example that I'm providing in front of this classroom, is just go along with whoever is, swinging at you the hardest, even if what they're pushing you to do is completely immoral and against your value system. Just go along with it, you know, for comity or for your pension or whatever. I mean, at some point there needs to be some accountability for people who know better and tolerate worse.
Well, and the crazy thing is, you know, what's really, I think, insidious about this is, again, I mean, I've known, I don't know, lots of I've interviewed thousands of teachers over the years. And again, almost without fail, right, left, they really do worry about their students. I mean, there's a handful of ideologues, but that's not the norm. And, you know, so they want all their teachers to feel comfortable. They want every teacher, they want every student to feel valued. They want students to feel like school is a place where they're safe and welcome. And what's insidious is that really healthy, responsible mindset on the part of teachers is being co-opted by people who say, the way you make every child feel valued is that you bring this kind of toxic division into your classroom. And teachers who've got, you know, a degree in elementary education, which wasn't all that rigorous, don't really have the language or the history or the grounding to push back. So they go, well, all right, I guess that's what I'm supposed to do. Mm. So in some sense, this is also a failure of our colleges and of our education system.
Yeah.
To give teachers the grounding and understanding to understand how and why they need to push back.
Yeah, yeah, good points. He is Rick Hess, Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Rick, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And, you know, I've connected the dots between the Safety Act and between this migrant shuffle that Pritzker and Lightfoot are doing, because it's just another installment in the long-running series of Chicago trying to extend its political influence by pushing its problems to the suburbs and the exurbs. Socialism is for sharing.
Right.
So push your influence by pushing your problems onto the region and make it regional problems, not Chicago problems. Blur the lines of distinction between the city and the suburbs. That has been the intent for a number of generations, and to their credit, they've been pretty effective at blurring those lines based on, well, you've seen the vote totals. You've seen the way the collar counties have moved left. So there's something to it, and this is just more of it, that what they're doing with the issue of the migrants being bussed up here, Pritzker declaring the state of emergency. Mm-hmm. That's what he likes to do, press the panic button, hold it down.
Sending 75 National Guard members to support local municipalities. So say if a busload goes to Elk Grove, they'll go out in front of that and try to, you know, arrange rooms and all that stuff.
And it is the case with the end of cash bail and the continued handcuffing of police when it comes to responding to crime, which is what the Safety Act does. And now that the Safety Act has become an international story, really.
Yep.
Now Pritzker and Lightfoot are trying to bail water on it by telling you things that are not true. And most people are not going to read the 800-page act. The pertinent sections are so poorly written, it's hard to decipher. That's part of the problem.
And I heard there's a lot of redundancy, too.
But some of the things are very clear. But you almost don't need to read it. You just need to follow the logic. Remember who is supporting this, who authored it, who's supporting it, who's currently defending it when they have to, mostly trying to deflect your attention away from it. These are the people. Our memory's this short. These are the people who turned the city streets over to rioters and looters, criminals, the summer of 2020, and made excuses for it, and had police stand down while the city was being torn asunder.
And criminals aren't stupid. I know, twice. They rented U-Hauls. They knew it was coming, so they're like, oh.
So
get bigger trucks to steal more stuff.
So those people, because it's the same people, Pritzker and Lightfoot, Fox, at the power structure, Preckwinkle, yeah, you know the names.
They're all there yesterday.
So the same people that did that in 2020, that ran interference for the Defund the Police, Black Lives Matter crews in 2020. Now you believe them when they're telling you on the heels of that, they authored and passed legislation that takes effect this January statewide that would get tougher on crime,
mm-hmm.
that would be tougher on people who commit acts of violence. Is that what you're seeing in Chicago and Cook County from Lightfoot and Fox? Is that what you're hearing from Pritzker? Is that what you saw and heard from them the summer of 2020? So how is it possible? Have they explained or articulated any change of heart? What we did previously, what we thought previously, it's not working, so we're doing something different. No, for them, this is a continuation of the approach they've taken to public safety from the beginning. Nothing new here. So if there's nothing new here, how could it be? Just logically, just follow a simple linear path. How is it possible that these people could be serious when they tell you that the Safety Act is in the interest of enhancing public safety and cracking down on repeat violent offenders? How is that possible? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Or is it more likely than not that they're lying to you?
Here is one of the big lies, one of many.
The Safety Act is designed to keep murderers and domestic abusers, violent criminals, in jail. And to address that, the problem of the current system, which allows those people, murderers, domestic abusers, and so on, to buy their way out of jail by just paying bail. So we're addressing the problem that exists today. Making sure that we're, you know, also addressing the problem of a single mother who shoplifted diapers for her baby, who is put in jail and kept there for 6 months because she doesn't have a couple of $100 to pay for bail. So that's what the Safety Act is about. Are there changes, adjustments that need to be? Of course. And there have been adjustments made, and there will continue to be. Laws are not immutable. They are not, you know, there with no change that's ever made to them. Of course. Of course.
Right, thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Clear the room. Clear the room. Can I just address one thing? That the mom, that he's the single mom who steals diapers, you know, for her baby. That mom is not going to get arrested. You have to get arrested if it's worth $500 or more to get arrested. So the example that he used doesn't even work anyway. But it's deeper than that.
So at the outset, this is going to keep violent criminals in jail. Really? How?
Well, he claims...
The D.C. press corps? I mean, the Chicago press corps? What's the difference? So it's enhancing prosecutors' ability to keep violent criminals in jail. How? How? What's the answer? Did he give one? Was it asked?
They rushed him away. Mm-hmm. They literally, when things start getting hot, sticky, a little uncomfortable, go, we're leaving. Well, I don't know where they're going. Why is everybody in such a hurry?
So is it the case that right now we don't have room in county jails because they're full of women who shoplifted pillows for their children? Is that who the jail population is, and we need to clear out these nonviolent offenders stealing to
feed their family,
take care of their family? Is that really who's in?
No.
Does anybody believe that?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And then on the back end, oh, of course there are tweaks that have been made. And oh, really?
What?
So what are the tweaks that have been made that you agree with and which you disagree with? And what are the tweaks you think should be made? Since you're such an expert on the topic, please provide the detail. We're here to listen and dutifully report. Is that asked? No, because you get to get away with if you're Pritzker or Lightfoot and this Chicago press corps and Springfield press corps, you get to get away with, hey, it's going to have this effect. I don't need to explain how. Yeah. I don't need to address any of the criticism. I'm just telling you, this is the positive effect it's going to have. And to the extent that there are some tweaks that need to be made, those tweaks have been made and other tweaks will be made as needed. Don't know what they are, but just rest assured that they'll be made. Okay, that's a wrap.
Gotta go.
All right. Who's going to Governor's Row? Is that still around? I haven't been out in the city in a while. I mean, honestly, this guy is on your side.
This guy is
This is public. This is what you want. This is what you believe you're going to get. You think your communities. And I'm not talking about Chicago. I'm talking about the collar counties, the exurbs, the rest of the state. You think your communities are going to be safer under this guy and his safety act with this routine you're just hearing? Tim in Lakewood, Illinois.
Yeah, Dan, you know, I'm really looking forward to January 1st. It's going to turn into the Wild West out there. I was talking to my wife the other day, and we're talking, if somebody's going to be sleeping in our yard or on one of our patio furnitures, what are you going to do? There's no trespassing anymore. Police aren't going to do anything.
They'll come and give a ticket.
You get a ticket.
It's your own problem.
No. You know what you do? You put a bullet in his head and you call waste management. Get the trash off my lawn.
Easy there. All right. Easy.
Well, thanks for the call, Tim. Well, I mean, that is one of the examples. I'd love for him to explain that example. I have a business. I have a home. Somebody trespasses. And if they don't commit an act of violence, but they won't leave, I can call police. And if and when they choose to arrive, knowing what they're limited to do, they can write him a ticket. They can ask him to leave the premises or escort him off the premises, and then he can return. And this can go on interminably. That's what you expect from your police? Well, that's what this law demands of them. Just one simple example. So, you know, it's not just the lack of punishment for violent criminals and the lack of detention of violent criminals who are a substantial enough portion to inflict real community damage will commit crimes when they are out. even awaiting trial. As we've seen, as has been documented by CWB Chicago over the last 2 years, 75 some examples in 2021. We're up to 35 such examples in 2022. We're talking about hundreds of lives, people who have been killed by people who should have been detained awaiting trial for violent crime. They're not.
Such as murder.
So the implications are real world. But even beyond the life and death issues, the quality of life. I mean, Tim from Lakewood, I mean, Wild West, the Wild West wasn't this wild because an armed society is a civil society. But this is putting law enforcement on the side of the criminals. I mean, not formally, but informally, because they cannot act to stop. So there is no law. There's the might makes right, Hobbesian state. Bob in West Chicago.
Yes, good morning, Dan. You mentioned earlier that the governor never worked before being governor, but I acknowledge that he did work to appeal the taxes on his residence, and he worked. He has apparently some nice properties on the Gold Coast.
Yeah,
and
nice
toilets.
Yeah,
probably. Wow. Okay. No, they did that to reduce his own taxes and deprive the schools of revenues from that.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Yeah, well, he has people.
$314,000.
He has people for that too. He had people to take the toilets out of his Gold Coast mansion to cheat on his property taxes, and he has people to take the fall for that. He blamed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of stand-up guy you're dealing with.
And she went and wrote a check, but it doesn't mean you didn't commit the crime. But no one pushed him on that.
I mean, it was raised. Rauner was just so pathetic and weak. Mm-hmm. He was a dead man walking at that point that it didn't matter. But it should be revisited. What kind of man is that?
It says a lot about his character, or lack of character.
And I'm not even talking about the property tax cheating. I'm talking about having your wife be your human shield. What kind of man is that? And what kind of man are the people out there supporting that kind of man? What kind of men are those men? I'm going to lay off the suburban women for a second. What kind of man are you, Pritzker supporter, supporting a man like that? Not to mention to the harm he is going to expose your family to starting January 1. How pathetic are you, men of Illinois, supporting someone like that? Paul and DeKalb.
Morning, guys. What people don't know, there's several ways people are held in jail on felonies. The judge can set a bond. In our jail here, we have several murderers that have bonds set. A judge has the opportunity to hold them on no bond. But since these two people I'm referring to are held with a bond of $5 million, they will be released January 1 because their bond is set.
There you go. Thanks. Paul, are you in law enforcement up there or out there in DeKalb?
I was retired deputy.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Winnebago County Sheriff said they're going to release 400-plus criminals.
The
January 1.
State's attorney.
State's attorney, excuse me.
Yeah. They're all. Everybody's lying except JB and Lori. Mm. Okay. Sure. Philip Westside.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Long time no call in. Hey, Dan, I have the. I think this is what's happening with this Pritzker thing and with all these governors around the country. Joe Biden's been hollering racism since he's been president, and it's a lie. It's not happening. I think what's happening is they want people to get out of jail and go in your garages and stuff. So when you shoot and kill them or protect yourself, what are they going to holler? Racism, racism, racism. People need to open their eyes. They're lying about everything. That was my comment.
Thanks for the call, Philip. Yeah, it's a good point. Always looking for an opportunity to race hustle, even over the dead. Even at the expense of the living. Mm-hmm. Bill in Cape Coral, Florida. Hey, Bill.
It's because one of the reasons they're doing this
is because the jails are so filled with criminals, they have to pay that. They have to pay to feed them. They have to pay. They can't take their little cuts out that they used to be able to hide the money from. So if they let them all out, they're not going to reduce the budget. They'll leave that budget, the jail budget, the same level, but there'll be no prisoners in there. And then they'll be able to skim here and skim there and take their money. That's my reason why I think they're letting them out.
Thanks for the call. I think the budget issue is way down the list. And, oh, by the way, just on this matter of reaction to this, 30 of the Illinois state's attorneys who opposed this are Democrats. Pritzker supporters. So are they fearmongers too? Are they racists? Are they MAGA extremists? 30 state's attorneys? County state's attorneys around this? I mean, Glasgow was one of them, the highest profile one in Will County. You want to play that game? Cannot win on the merits. So he has to get away with race hustling and telling beautiful lies to a compliant, ignorant, pathetic, weak Chicago press corps. That's the playbook. Pretty simple. Pretty simple.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's run through about a year and a half of agitprop on inflation from Mr. 10% and his regime mates. So what you'll hear in order, Yellen in March of 2021... Captain Kangaroo, the Treasury Secretary. Psaki.
Oh, you get to say your name again.
I know,
again.
It's fun. That's why I'm doing this. So first, Captain Kangaroo impersonator, the Treasury Secretary, March of 21. Then Psaki in March of 2022. Then Biden this past April. Then Biden just last month. Are you ready? Here you go.
Is there a risk of inflation? I think there's a small risk, and I think it's manageable.
Temporary, a transitory impact. We also believe it will be temporary and not long-lasting.
Putin's invasion of Ukraine has driven up gas prices and food prices all over the world. I don't understand.
Today, we received news that our economy had 0% inflation in the month of July.
That is hilarious.
Funny, funny, funny people. This is so obvious now. Even CBS News, as a representative of the D.C. press corps, even they can't fail to acknowledge it. Take a listen to this, a portion of this CBS News report on the numbers.
Government figures show groceries climbing more than 13% on average, electricity spiking nearly 16%, and rent up nearly 7% over the last year. Those high prices, plus the likelihood the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates again, sent the markets tumbling. Just as the president and Democrats were celebrating passage of their Inflation Reduction Act.
A single most important legislation passed in the Congress to combat inflation, and one of the most significant laws in our nation's history, in my view.
The new law provides funding to fight climate change, ease health care costs, and hike taxes on big corporations. But it does nothing to address short-term price hikes.
Wait a second.
Wait. James Taylor was there singing Fire and Rain.
CBS News said that the Inflation Reduction Act, as it's titled, does nothing to address inflation? Wow, that really is a game changer.
They're starting to wake up. CNN, they were covering his celebration on the White House lawn and cut out of it and said, basically, the inflation numbers were higher than predicted in August.
For more on this, Steve Moore, economist, Trumponomics author, and more recently, Govzilla, how the relentless growth of government is devouring our economy and our freedom, you don't say. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning, guys. By the way, I was in the Chicagoland area this weekend. Something for Darren Bailey. We got to win that race. We had about 400 people at the King County Fairgrounds. So that was a
the rally.
Poured rain on Sunday, but we had a great time. We missed you, Dan, and we missed you, Amy. Okay, so I want to say something about this this press conference because it really was. I mean, it was just the big victory lap celebration the Biden administration had. What was that, Tuesday night, I think it was. And, you know, so I'm watching CNN, I'm watching Fox News on the TV screen while they're having this, quote, celebration and victory lap. And while they're doing it, you know how, Dan, they meet at the bottom of the screen, they have the stock market ticker on these shows?
Yeah, right.
Well, the market, every 5 minutes, the stock market is going down, 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 down. And he's talking about how great the economy is. You know, we get this terrible inflation report. And so it was almost surreal, actually, that they were that stupid that they would do this. But there was one good thing. So you're not being entirely fair here, Dan. At
Me?
Least they had James Taylor. They had James Taylor.
I mean, it's terrible. Yeah, I never liked James Taylor.
Drumming on this. On the guitar, so that was...
Isn't that Redux? It wasn't James Taylor over in France with Horseface a couple of years ago doing the same routine before? Haven't we seen this act before?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, look, I want to get this point out, too. You know, you talked about food prices and all these other things, Amy. We've talked about that week after week about how expensive groceries are. But do you know what was one of the biggest increase in prices over the last year? In terms of something that consumers buy, the American families buy every year.
Yes. Oh no.
Yes.
Cars.
So I'll just tell you. Well, cars. Yeah, absolutely. Look, cars are up. Transportation costs, rental cars. Household items. But one of the biggest increases. This kind of leapt out at me when I looked at the list of all the things that are going up in price. Health insurance. Hmm. Now,
that can't be because we've got Obamacare.
Cannot be. We passed the Affordable Care Act.
It can't be. Wait a second.
Double digits?
That's almost like saying, like, you're telling me that when the government gets involved in something, that the prices increase. That would be novel, wouldn't it? Have we ever seen that before?
Well, also, it would mean that because they said that they were going to make this healthcare more affordable, but it's up by 14.5%. I don't know. That seems like it's making it less affordable. Maybe I'm missing something here because, you know, this was supposed to make all our healthcare problems go away.
Yeah. Well, but now to be fair, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is going to make our unaffordable, then affordable, then unaffordable healthcare affordable again.
Right. And so, yeah, incidentally, I just literally just right before I came on the show, I finished my weekly column. And it's about here's another irony. Man, Biden administration is rich with irony. So 3 or 4 days ago, they have Biden has this big celebration for his. He was at, I think, the Harvard School, Kennedy School at Harvard. And he's launched his cancer moonshot. Did you see that? The cancer moonshot. So he's going to solve cancer.
I thought he was supposed to do that before the end of Obama's second term. Is he still working on that?
No, that didn't work out too well. So I'm writing my column and it's like, wait a minute. He's saying, oh, we're going to have all this new money for cancer research. No, folks. This bill that he signed yesterday or the day before, that bill takes $300 billion out of the truck industry and gives it to the wind and solar valve companies. So that bill that he signed on Tuesday, the Inflation Reduction Act, actually loses the race for the cure because when you price controls on something and you take $300 billion from an industry, do you think people want to invest more in it?
I know your training is in the field of economics, not electoral handicapping, but... what's your review of the Republican messaging into this mess here as we stand 8 weeks out from Election Day?
Well, you know, my view has always been that the Republicans are the lesser of two evils, right? They're the lesser of two evils. So that's not a rousing applause for what Republicans have been doing. I mean, a lot of Republicans voted for this. Now, none of the Republicans voted for this inflation, what I call the Inflation Acceleration Act. But the Republicans have their hands dirty on the spending problem, too. But I think, look, the economy is facing some really tough times. It's in big trouble right now. I think let's stop with the happy talk. This is we've borrowed $4 trillion over the last, 20 months. You know, bills come due. It's going to be a rough period. And so if it is the economy stupid, as James Carville once said, then we should see, Republicans will pick up, I would say, 30 seats in the House and maybe, two or three, four Senate seats and the governor's races. But we'll see. I mean, look, the polls are not especially good right now for the Republican. I mean, they're decent, but not great. And I got to tell you, though, if you look at 2010 and 1994, the two big, big, massive, actually same thing in 1980, 1994 and 2010 were the big, massive Republican routs of the Democrats. In each one of those situations, the big red wave didn't come in until the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
So you know, it's too early to predict what's going to happen, but I still think you're going to have a red wave election. I mean, why would if you're happy with the way things are going in America, folks, then you should vote for Biden. I mean, I don't know. Amy, are you happy with the way things
no,
are going?
No, I'm not, and I don't care about climate change. I mean, I do my things to recycle, but right now most Americans don't care about that. They care about inflation. And then the Inflation Reduction Act does nothing to address that. And people are like, okay, well, he's doing something without actually reading what it does, which is nothing.
Well put. And I would simply – I want to explain one quick thing to you, this listeners, because this is important. I know you have the smartest listeners in the Chicago area. So this is just a primer. If you raise taxes by $500 billion on businesses, Amy, do you think that – that's going to lead to lower prices or higher prices?
They're going to pass that on to the consumers, Steve.
Of course. Okay. Yes. So that means higher prices, right? Okay. Yes. Now, if you put $500 billion out there and printed money in more spending, do you think that's going to raise prices or lower prices?
I think it's going to raise prices.
So these idiots in Washington say, hey, we're going to have $500 billion in new taxes and $500 billion in new spending, and they're going to cancel each other out. No, they they'll cancel each other out. They both have the effect of making inflation worse. But these people, I mean, really, the towering stupidity of some of these economists, there are 100 prominent economists who actually said this bill is going to lower inflation. Of course, these are the same ones. Remember, Dan, about a year and a half ago when all those Nobel Prize winners said, was the first bill?
17 Nobel Prize winners. 17. No fewer than 17.
Yeah. I think they should send their Nobel Prizes back. Yeah. And say, oops, we don't know what we're talking about.
I think the 17 Nobel Prize winners need to be tethered together, and they have to move in mass wherever they, ambulate around the globe, since they're the 17. It's not like the they sound like the League of Justice, the 17 Nobel Prize winners. I mean, this is so it's cartoonish the way that we talk about this stuff. The 17s have pronounced.
But you would think, though, that, I've made wrong predictions myself. By the way, I was wrong about this inflation report. I think I said on your show last week, I thought inflation was going to come down. I was wrong.
Ever the optimist.
What happened was gas prices did come down. They're down by about $1.25 from the high of $5 or $6 a gallon, but everything else went up in price. I mean, everything from, the food prices, the transportation costs, blah, blah, blah. And so I admit sometimes I'm wrong, but if I made a completely crazy, lunatic, wrong prediction, I wouldn't go out the next day and, double down on that prediction. I'd say maybe I'd keep my mouth shut for a while.
What do you expect? So now you've set the table. So what do you expect going forward, particularly after the expected rate hike next week?
I think the economy is really slowing down. And I think, we're in, look at what's happening in Europe right now. Do you know what people are paying for gasoline, Amy, in London today?
I think it's $10, $8.
Yeah, close to $10 a gallon. Oof. All we have to do is look at what these other countries have done, because they're ahead of us on the green energy crap, right? They've tried this stuff. They're running. You know what they're using for fuel now in many of European countries, Dan?
What?
Coal?
Firewood.
Oh, full firewood, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, are we living in the Middle Ages?
Yeah, well, we're going back to a simpler time, a more bucolic existence, Steve. It's very romantic.
Yeah, of course, burning firewood is like the worst thing you can do. And by the way, what about the trees? We need more trees so we can come back.
Who's going to save the trees if everybody's burning firewood?
Tie ourselves to one. Don't take it.
Oh, my gosh. So great. Steve Moore, economist, Trumponomics, and GovZilla author. Steve, thanks as always.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't want to go back to Chicago and crime, but sort of feel compelled to, in part because of the remarks yesterday, which we haven't gotten to yet, at the Economic Club of Chicago by McDonald's CEO Chris Kibczynski. It's interesting what he had to say. And remember, this is somebody who, like most of these Fortune 500 CEOs, tiptoes around politics, particularly when it comes to big cities, issues of race, or issues where race can be injected by the race hustlers like we have with Lightfoot and Pritzker. You know, he's got a lot of franchises and franchisees, and obviously McDonald's is now headquartered in Chicago after moving from Oak Brook. So he tiptoes around these issues, generally speaking. Remember, he apologized after texts to Lightfoot were made public. He texted Lightfoot, did Chris Kibczynski, back after Adam Toledo and the 7-year-old girl, Jaslyn. What was her last name? Jaslyn. I'm blanking on her last name. 7-year-old girl that was killed in the drive through in the McDonald's on the west side. After those two kids were killed, he texted Lightfoot that the parents or those parents failed those kids. And then he apologized because, oh my gosh, that was somehow insensitive. No, it was actually obvious, but he apologized nonetheless.
Well, because the parents were gangbangers and wanted, and they had their kids in their car.
Well, the point is to say,
kids got killed instead of them.
This is about, you know, how sensitive someone like him in his position is going to be to saying anything that can be purposely misconstrued so that people can play the victim card, which is exactly what happened, and thus his apology, which he shouldn't have done, but this is to tell you what kind of approach he takes. You know, past behavior is instructive. So this is in part what he said yesterday at the Economic Club. There's a so how measured this guy is. Factor that into these words. There's a general sense out there that our city is in crisis. The truth is, it's more difficult for me to convince a McDonald's executive to relocate to Chicago from one of our other offices than it was just a few years ago. It's more difficult for me to recruit a new employee to McDonald's to join us in Chicago than it was in the past. As the anti-business business rag Cranes reports, he talked up the positive parts of Chicago, the lakefront. Everybody always goes to the lakefront. Anything positive you have to say about the people? You know, yeah. I understand the natural beauty. How about the inhabitants? Well, the inhabitants, that's where it gets a little dicey. No, but he said the lakefront, the diversity, as if that's like something unique to Chicago. You get diversity in a mid-sized suburb. I mean, diversity. Everybody's genuflection before diversity. But he says that it shouldn't be this hard to find the positives to talk up Chicago. He says, sort of in open outcry to the political leadership, such as it is, let us know the plan so we can support it. It's going to take partnership. Yeah, I wouldn't be so open-ended with my support. Whatever you come up with, we'll support. No. In point of fact, maybe some broad strokes about what a sensible plan that addresses these crises that you're describing, so that the political class could take their cues from people who maybe know how to run a business, how to create jobs and opportunities and wealth. Mm. He said the city needs to do a better job at telling the positive parts of its story so the negatives don't dominate. Yeah, it's not a marketing problem there, Chris. But this is, you know, remember who you're talking to. Who's talking, I should say, and who we're talking about. Any criticism, even gentle, coming from the McDonald's CEO, I mean, that should be received as screaming from the rooftops. That's how reticent someone like him is to make critical comments.
Well, it reminds me of NBC pulling your ad, you know, because we have to protect the people in Chicago are so fragile. It bothers them. Well, they're already showing it, and they've already done stories on it and showed that footage a gazillion times anyway. But, you know, the perception of, we don't want a bad perception of Chicago, especially in something big like a Packers-Bears Sunday night football game. It's all beautiful lies. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
In our business, Chris Kipczynski, McDonald's CEO, says, other people's perception becomes our reality. We have to act like it's the reality, whether we believe it or not. Well, you don't have to act like anything's the reality. When that 7-year-old girl gets murdered in your drive-thru on the west side, when you have 9 people shot and 2 people killed outside your McDonald's on State in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, that's not perception. That is reality.
Sorry, there's bloodstains in your parking lot, but they are there.
Yeah. One thing about McDonald's, whatever is happening in society, good or bad, you can be sure it's happening at McDonald's. Oh, you mean like a kid being sexually assaulted in your bathroom at the old Hard Rock?
For a second time now? That happened before.
And I'm not blaming McDonald's. I'm certainly not blaming Chris Kipczynski. I'm saying, stop pretending that Chicago has a perception problem, has a marketing problem. Hey, what about the lakefront? I got it. Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I've lived on the lakefront for the last 15 years. It's very enjoyable, you know, as long as you don't have to avoid gunfire to enjoy, you know, the Ohio Street Beach or meandering around Navy Pier where there was a shootout 4 nights ago.
Yeah, 11 shell casings.
I know these are one-off incidents, but in the aggregate, they're not. And it seems to me, when we're talking with Steve Moore about what happens in terms of November 8th and whether this is going to be a wave election or not, you know, I understand the inflationary issue and what it's doing to household budgets and what it's doing to economic insecurity, how anxious it's making families, not just making ends meet on a daily basis or weekly or monthly basis with your groceries, with your power costs and so forth, but also thinking about, especially those nearing retirement, what's my retirement going to look like? It's tracking a lot different in the last year than it was before this regime took over, isn't it? And so I get all that, but I don't know, and the polling doesn't necessarily bear me out on this, but a poll is a snapshot in time. If there's going to be a reckoning, if there's going to be a revolt, if there's going to be a wave, I think it's going to be on public safety.
You think so?
I really do, which is sort of why I've spent so much time emphasizing it, particularly because of Chicago and because of the Safety Act. With the pack that I run, I just think that you have to always start with first priorities, and the first of the first priorities is my safety and my family's safety.
And I just thought there was going to be a blue wave because of abortion rights.
Well, there's no circumstance under which there's going to be a blue wave.
I'm just saying, I think more.
But if
independence people that I think that would, women who would normally sit out this midterm election or the governor's race, I think that they might be more inclined to go vote.
If you have Republican nominees who mishandle the issue, it can mitigate against Republican successes, yes. It's not going to be a wave, and it's not going to be anything that engenders a revolt. It seems to me, yes, pocketbook issues, yes, this 40-year high inflation, that is something that is different, and it has the potential to be paradigm shifting. I get it. Like it was from Carter to Reagan, from the late 70s to the entire decade of the 80s. It has that possibility. But but like the 70s into the 80s, there was also a crime issue. Huge crime issue in places like New York City that informed some of the decisions that voters made at the state, local, and federal levels. And I think you may be seeing the confluence of those two again in 2022, 50 years later. Well, 40 years later, but yeah, from the 70s to the 80s. I don't know. That's just my intuition based on sort of hearing and reading and seeing and trying to divine both the data as well as just the general sort of sense of what people are saying, where they're focused on. I mean,
and that's why the Safety Act is so important to get Pritzker out of office, just for that alone.
Well, and think about too. I mean, what is dominating the conversation in your circles right now when it comes to anything policy related or political politics related? I think my sense is, I mean, certainly is for me, but my sense is generally it's much more people trying to get a handle on the Safety Act and the implications than it is trying to deal with their household budget. I mean, and maybe that's just because public safety is seen as more of a community group thing, and my household budget and my finances as a personal thing, maybe. That's what I said. So it's not one to the exclusion of the other. I think it's a confluence. But I think crime is the emotional piece that's leading the possibility for a revolt against the established order in places like New York, Chicago, and elsewhere.
Because people went from not knowing anybody who got carjacked to now knowing two or three people who've been carjacked. And that's just the beginning. And no one takes a CTM. If you want to see your son or daughter at the end of the day, you don't put them on a bus or a train.
Brian and Elsa up here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. So I wanted to talk about people play by the rules of your pack, Dan. I really think that it's an effective commercial, how you have the video of the woman getting robbed by three guys. I would like to try and pitch an idea to you to have something, a commercial about the Safety Act. Maybe you could have, you know, a video of him signing a bill, J.B. Pritzker, and list all of the things, you know, the second degree murder, we're going to let people out, and
cashless bail. That was my first ad, the Summer of Joy ad that preceded the Scream ad, actually.
I must not have caught that one. Yeah. I guess I'm not always watching TV.
Yeah, it's possible.
But was it a bunch of mini clips of like crime? I mean, I think it'd be effective now because people, I have a family member who's a Democrat who yesterday sent me a petition to repeal the Safety Act. This person still plans on voting for J.B. Pritzker, but they're, you know, motivated enough to try and get me to sign a petition to repeal the act. So
that's
how do you need to tie it to him a little more, I think.
Wait, your relative doesn't understand that the Safety Act doesn't exist without J.B. Pritzker signing it. He or she hasn't seen J.B. Pritzker defending it and trying to explain it away on media. I mean, I don't. What is confusing to your relative? Do you think? I mean, I ask that seriously because that's baffling.
Okay, I'll explain to you seriously. The years of people convincing people not to vote for Republicans. You know, I mean, even a lot of the black people I know, they'll never vote Republican. They hate Democrats. They know they're bad, but there's something embedded in their psychology that they just won't do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I can see like, okay, I can't get over the psychosis I'm suffering from against Republicans, but how can you at the one time be circulating a petition to repeal the Safety Act and then say, I'm still voting for Pritzker?
I had the same comment.
Yeah.
What did they say?
Comment. You're still going to vote. Well, when I brought up that, you know, the cashless bail will allow people who've
will get out for second-degree murder or whatever. They said, oh, it doesn't actually say that in the bill. And I said, well, then why don't you support the bill? And it goes nowhere, you know?
Is it possible for you to get power of attorney over that relative and have that relative institutionalized, do you think?
Hey, it's not just one, it's many. They all complain about the crime. They complain about Kim Fox. They're against almost everyone who's a Democrat. They don't like Joe Biden. They don't like Kim Fox. They, for some reason, like J.B. Pritzker. I don't know why. So I don't know what to do at this point.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Yeah, I mean, all you can do is continue to sort of work the logic like you did and then hope that some sort of breakthrough occurs. I don't know. I don't know. Those are the kind of conversations that, have me pacing at night. Andy in Hinsdale.
So Bloomberg, of all places, actually had a very good article yesterday that quoted a bunch of your regular functionaries like Arne Duncan and everything. But one of the people quoted in the article was a guy named Don Wilson. Don
DRW Trading.
Yeah. Very rarely comes up for air in civic discussions. But he's probably, if not the top, he's probably in the top five of wealthiest self-made people left in Chicago after Ken Griffin's departure.
Yeah.
And Wilson had some very sobering quotes in this article. I'll send the article to you, but it's notable that a guy like him would actually be stepping up and speaking out about this now. I think it really confirms that you are over the target with your ads, and this is being taken seriously.
Well, Don, I mean, you probably know this, Andy, but Don Wilson has a lot of property interests in Chicago too. He developed a hotel in Streeterville. He bought the old theater
and Gold Theater.
Yep, exactly. So he's got some things that he can't just pick up and move either.
Sure, but he does not come out in public and talk.
No, I agree. General. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
So,
no, that is
interesting.
Notable to
see. Yeah.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Yeah. Well, hopefully that encourages more. It should not take, Perilli type of event, a break in at your place, your employees put in danger for executives in the city to speak out. It shouldn't take that. I mean, again, I put the same question to them that I put to all the voters through the ads I'm running. How much worse does it have to get? How much worse does it have to get before you just say something? For God's sake. Rob, Ukrainian Village.
Hey, to your point earlier about personal finances versus public safety, I think a lot of people view personal finances as it's a pride issue. If you're living paycheck to paycheck and you need to pull yourself out, you got to tighten your belt, pull your boots up and get to work and pull yourself out of it. And a lot of times it's to move to that safer community and provide a better environment for you and your family. So when the safety of that environment that you've busted your butt to get to starts to deteriorate, that's when it becomes a community issue that people concern themselves with, more outside of what they can personally control.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Thanks for the call, Rob. Ralph Rantoul.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I know that you two do a great job of covering the more of the details in these crime stories. What I don't understand, and maybe Amy, you can address it. I don't know how much of your stuff that you wrote when you were in TV and radio, TV exclusively. But when I hear stories read, even now on this station, and they include known gangbangers, details that were in the police report or whatnot, they're often excluded. And rather than hearing the story like three people shot in a car, why don't we hear the stories read more like four people riding in a car, known gangbangers, shot at by three other known gangbangers. When the facts are known, why aren't they provided? And then on a completely different note, I need somebody with musical talent to help me because I'm reworking the lyrics for the Men Without Hats safety dance. And I got the first line going, we can kill if we want to because we
could kill if we want to because we know we don't go to jail.
All right. Very good, Ralph.
And in regards to your gangbanger comment, I mean, sometimes they say they're known gang members. Like, well, when the 7-year-old girl was shot, they finally came out and said her dad was the target. Or the 5-year-old who got shot in the face, lived for 3 days, and then passed away. A kindergartner, you know, 3 days of school in. His dad was the intended target.
Yeah, but
so they let us know.
Jaslyn Adams. Adams was her last name. Yeah. Jaslyn Adams. When they talked about her father, they said he was the target, but they didn't make it explicit why he was the target. You're still left to interpret. Why don't you tell us what you know to be true? Yeah. Jordan Forest Park.
You know, I think we need to get rid of the doublespeak and actually rename the Safety Act. Now, I've come up with an idea. It's called the CRAP Act, C-R-A-P, mm-hmm. Criminal Release Protection Act. You know, protecting criminals from arrest, being held, in some cases being prosecuted. Okay? The CRAP Act. Let's start calling it what it is.
Thanks for the call, although it doesn't work with the Men Without Hats parody, the CRAP Act.
Justin, you should start working on that.
All right, safety, yeah.
Safety Act.
I mean,
it's Safety Act.
I don't know if we can have like an upbeat pop song about murder and mayhem, but yeah. I like the creativity out there.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That Heisman Trophy winner running for office in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, was on. She's the one. They got no?
No. Walker. No,
it was Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker. I get those two I get those two football players confused. Stacey Abrams was on The View to bitch about her 2018 election.
Is she still complaining about that?
As the setup to bitch about her 2022 election in Georgia. Here's what she had to say about, you know, things that she never said. So she says.
And there is this clip that's going around, and it shows me saying that we won. And what I was referring to was that we won in terms of communities that were long left out of the electoral process,
right.
Finally participated in 18 at outstanding numbers.
People were laughing.
I'm not delusional. So.
I beg to differ. There's so many ways to win. I don't look at winning or losing based on the scoreboard, Amy.
Uh-huh.
If you did your best,
then you're a winner, winner, chicken dinner.
If you engage communities that were disenfranchised, then you're a winner all day long. But here's what actually Stacey Abrams has spent the better part of the last 4 years saying.
I do have one very affirmative statement to make. We won.
You refuse to concede and say that you lost. Do you stand by that decision today?
Absolutely. The election was not fair. The process was not fair.
Was the election in Georgia statewide a free and fair election?
It was not a free and fair election. But will I say that this election was not tainted, was not a disinvestment and a disenfranchisement of thousands of voters? I will not say that.
You notably did not concede.
I did not.
Okay, you acknowledged that he won, but you did not concede.
Correct.
5 months later, do you still feel like your opponent won through voter suppression?
Yes. Georgia voters did not have their votes counted. They were not allowed to cast votes.
Oh, really?
They had their votes discarded. And it was not fair to those who filled out absentee ballots. And depending on the county you sent it to, it either was counted or not counted, assuming you received it in time. Brian Kemp oversaw for 8 years the systematic and systemic dismantling of our democracy.
It's funny because I thought Brad Raffensperger and Brian Kemp were heroes of our democracy when they stood athwart Trump and the effort to get various recounts done to their satisfaction after the 2020 election. Which is it? I mean, to be a leftist must be to be very confused on the topic. For more, or a never-Trumper, but I repeat myself. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Fred Lucas. He's the chief news correspondent and manager of the Investigative Reporting Project for the Daily Signal, which is a product of the Heritage Foundation. He's got a new book, The Myth of Voter Suppression. Myth?
What?
the myth of voter suppression, the left's assault on clean elections. Fred, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I don't understand. You said it's a myth. You just heard Stacey Abrams say unequivocally that Brian Kemp has spent, first of all, he won through voter suppression in 2018, and he spent the last 8 years dismantling the ability of people to vote in Georgia, which, gosh, it must make it very tough for her to run again if there's no possibility of victory since people can't vote in Georgia.
Well, of course, that's not true. The 2018 election actually saw massive increase in minority voter turnout and showed massive increase in Democratic voter turnout, actually, that year in Georgia. And in that particular race, Stacey Abrams deserves credit for coming closer than any Democrat had in a really long time to being governor of the state of Georgia, but she lost. She lost, in fact, she lost by 55,000 votes. That's well outside the margin of any fraudulent elections are usually decided by. And it's also about five times larger than what Donald Trump lost Georgia by. And he made sort of similar complaints than what Stacey Abrams made, but the mainstream media labeled that as very dangerous, while Stacey Abrams has gotten mostly fawning attention.
She's a heroine, and Trump is on heroin, according to the D.C. press corps, basically. Right. Yeah, that's exactly right, and even though the accusations are strikingly similar, although perhaps Trump's are a bit more specific, at least from the Cleta Mitchell readout in the call they had with Raffensperger. But I don't want to get down that rabbit hole. Just the larger issue of voter suppression, because it's one of those phrases the left gets to throw out without having to provide any evidentiary backup. And so how do you address these allegations of voter suppression in Georgia and just generally?
Well, importantly, and as the book, The Myth of Voter Suppression, it lays out, you can comb through the U.S. code and you will never find the words voter suppression. What is illegal under the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which has been a smashing success of the law in terms of increasing the number of people who vote. But what is illegal is vote denial, vote dilution, and voter intimidation. Now, the left, I think voter suppression is basically a focus group term that the left uses to lump in illegal activity with legal activity, which is legal activity meaning basic laws to ensure the integrity of the ballot, such as voter ID.
Voter ID is
actually supported by about 80% of the public all across demographics.
But so that's voter intimidation to the left, but it's not voter intimidation if you have Black Panther standing outside a polling place in Philadelphia telling you who to vote for.
Democrats did not think so. No, they there was a the book gets into that a little bit. The DOJ had a case lined up, and then the Obama administration came in. The Eric Holder Justice Department pretty much quit.
Well, in your book, you mentioned how easy it is to vote in certain states like Georgia and Texas and Delaware and New York. So walk us through that.
Yeah. And this is an important point. You actually have the states that were really maligned and attacked during this were Georgia, Texas in particular. But it's easier to vote in those states in terms of the number of days you have to vote. Most of these states have no-fault absentee balloting, whereas New York has fairly strict laws in terms of balloting. New York actually has the same law about whether you can have food or drink in the voting line or whether people can distribute that in the voting line as Georgia did. You might remember that was one of the big one-liners that got thrown out at, over the Georgia law. It was like, people aren't allowed to drink water in the voting lines there. There's also in Delaware just recently, they had enacted a mail-in voting law that got thrown out by court just yesterday, actually. And Delaware still still had, even under their new law, they still had fewer days for absentee voting than Georgia did, even before this law. And Georgia pretty much maintained the same number of days for early voting. So, I mean, so much of this is much ado about nothing. Colorado, and this is one thing that's interesting. Colorado actually has somewhat stricter voting laws than Georgia. And you might remember that Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game out of Atlanta into Denver.
To Colorado. Oh, yeah, I recall. You know, go back to that that water bottle thing, because Abrams brought that up again yesterday with those man-hating shrews on The View. That, you know, you can't even pass out a water to people, you know, about to perish while waiting to vote. I mean, these whole scenarios are so preposterous. But and she said that's just cruel. We're being cruel to people. We're trying to, you know, cause people to die of water deprivation while they try to exercise their franchise. Fred, how can that be so?
Well, that's not, that characterization is not true, for one. And I mentioned Montana and New York have the same law regarding food and drink in line. It's political. The poll workers, the election workers, can give out water in line. This prohibits within 150 feet of the polling place, which is actually fairly close to the building you're going to be voting in. Nobody can hand food and drink. And now this is...
Say that again. You cut out for a second. Nobody can what?
Nobody who with a campaign can hand out food and drink or anything of value within 150 feet of a polling place. 150 feet is actually fairly close to the building you're voting in.
How many people do you know?
If you're talking about people who are
for the research for your book. Do you know how many people have died of starvation or water deprivation while waiting to get from 150 feet outside the polling place to inside the polling place to vote?
I didn't research that particular point. I would suggest it's probably zero.
Yeah,
probably. Abrams might know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is so. And now the flip side is the constant claims that ridiculous, more and more ridiculous, of voter suppression and voter intimidation. As balanced against the claims of shenanigans, like, you know, what is more, what should be more of a concern to free and fair elections, people actually interested in free and fair elections? Is it the voter suppression side that Stacey Abrams and others on the left prattle on about, or is it the ballot integrity side in an era of Zucker boxes and ever-changing rules with respect to absentee ballots and so forth?
Yeah, it's definitely the voter fraud side. And we brought up Trump, his side, and the book gets in that, myths of voter suppression. It does say Trump and his legal team said some irresponsible things that panned out not to be true. However, the facts are voter fraud is demonstrably, factually, a problem. And there's evidence of that. There's evidence of that in overturned elections. There's evidence of that in people going to jail for voter fraud, convictions, and so forth down the line. And you can look at cases where this happened. What you cannot find among and what the people who are warning about this dire threat of voter suppression cannot present to us is a single individual who is eligible to vote but was prevented from voting. They've done various litigation about what might happen, what could happen, who is disproportionately affected, but they have not produced any individual case where an eligible voter was prevented from voting.
Mm. Fred Lucas, chief news correspondent and manager of the Investigative Reporting Project for the Daily Signal, product of the Heritage Foundation. His new book, The Myth of Voter Suppression, The Left's Assault on Clean Elections. Fred, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.